All right, ladies and gentlemen. Wow, this is just so impressive, this background. I would turn around, but that would like not work with this thing. Yeah, it looks really cool. If you're right? Looks yes. Such a dramatic background. Hey, everybody. And hey, everybody. Yes, good to see. Oh, is it?
The post.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's a beam of light. Some sort of beam. All right, welcome to Torah Studies. This is our weekly exploration of the Torah portion. This week's Torah portion is Vayechi. So this is the 12th and final Torah portion of the book of Genesis. It seems like, what, only 12 weeks ago that we started this? Right? Literally. So we began in the beginning, and we end with the end. So the Torah portion of Vayechi mainly talks about the passing and the final words, the final actions, the final words, the final sentiments of our patriarch, Jacob. Yaakov Avinu, Jacob, our forefather. So the portion, in a sense, kind of wraps things up, and we begin. It's interesting. There's so many interesting themes here. We begin the book with promise and hope. You know, creation, everything's new and shiny and fresh. Everything's got that new car, new world, new universe smell. And then by the end, all the patriarchs are gone. The Jews are in Egypt. Joseph is dead, and that's how Joseph passed away. And that's how literally the last word. Okay, let's open up the Chumash. I'll show you what I'm talking about. The Torah portion begins on 318, 319 in the Gunnic edition, 318, 3 Chai. And 3 chai plus 1. And the Torah portion ends, I want to refer to the last verse, literally the last verse of the portion of the book of Genesis, the book of Bereishis, on page 340 and 341, in the English is, you guys see it, 341? 341. Okay. It says, Yosef died at the age of 110 years. They embalmed him, and he was placed in a coffin in Egypt. And thus ends, hey Alex, if you don't mind, just pull over a chair in a corner on the side.
Hey Alex.
So the book of Genesis, the book of Bereishis ends with Joseph passing away, being embalmed, I mean placed in a coffin in Egypt. And a person could think, a person could say, and maybe rightfully so, that it's a bit of a depressing ending. You know, it's a bit of a depressing ending. It's ending on such a low with He passes away, it's put in a coffin, and what do we say when we read it in the synagogue in Shul? Chazak, chazak, v'nis chazek. Awesome, be strong, be strong, be strengthened. Joseph's in a coffin in Egypt. Woo, we finished the book. I mean, it's a bit of a downer. It begins with so much promise, and it ends with the precipitation, if you will, of enslavement, of slavery. Nonetheless, you know, what begins as potential ends with more potential, begins with potential of creation, it ends with more potential and the refinement that's going to happen in Egypt. But that's not the theme that we're going to speak of. I just wanted to mention that as we talk about coming full circle. The theme of tonight is pure education. What it means to educate a child in a pure fashion, what it means to put ourselves in a situation of purity and educational purity in a clean and pure space that may or may not have anything to do with what the title of the class is here. But trust me, as we go through tonight's theme, that will have everything to do with what our discussion will be tonight. As I mentioned before, in this Torah portion, Yaakov Avinu, Jacob, our forefather, passes away. And the opening verse talks about how old he was when these final moments, when these final episodes of his life take place. Dan, please get us started, page 319 in the English.
Yaakov lived in the land of Egypt for 17 years. The total of Yaakov's days, years of his life, were 147 years.
Okay, so the Torah portion opens up by telling us how old he was. He lived in Egypt Yaakov lived for 17 years, and he lived a total of 147 years. How old was he when he got to Egypt? 130. And we already know that, by the way, last week's Torah portion, Because it says that when Jacob moves to Egypt, he meets Pharaoh, and Pharaoh says, how old are you? And he says, I'm 130, but they've been very difficult years. They've been very hard and tough and rough years. I'm 130. So the 17 years total is, survey says, boom, 147. Please continue.
When the time drew near for Israel to die, he called his son Yosef and said to him, if I have now found favor in your eyes, please place your hand beneath my thigh and swear on an oath that you will do for me true kindness. Please don't let me be buried in Egypt. Let me lie with my fathers. Carry me out of Egypt and bury me in their grave. I will do as you say, said Yosef. Yaakov said, swear to me, and he swore to him. Then Israel bowed down to Yosef, turning toward the divine presence, which was at the top of the bed.
Okay, so here we have the opening episode. Yaakov senses that his end is near, so he calls Yosef and he says, promise that you will not bury me in Egypt. Take me back to the cave of Machpelah in Hebron, and there you shall bury me. And he says, I promise I will do so, and indeed that's what happens. Subsequently, let's go through the themes of the Torah portion. Yaakov then blesses Ephraim and Manasseh, the two sons of Yosef, the two sons of Joseph. Then we have Yaakov blessing the rest of his sons, his 12 sons. That's on page 327. Yaakov blesses, or at least remarks about all 12 of his sons, and it's a very powerful elements of prophecy. And that ends pretty much toward the end of the Torah portion, where it tells us about Yaakov's passing. Yaakov passes away. It's recounted here in 335, and he's buried. It talks about that on 337. And then it talks about the aftermath in 339, what happens after Yaakov passes away. And then it talks about Yosef's passing away, and the Torah portion, the book of Genesis, ends.
I just wondered, you mentioned about how we start Genesis, Rashid, with this, the creation and the beauty of creation, and then we end with all of this death and burial.
Yeah.
So there is this full life cycle. I know we're not going to go down that path tonight, but it is... Nothing is by design. No, nothing is
by accident.
Random,
right?
So there is an amazing beauty in that full life cycle of Yeshua.
And I think it's amazing that the final Torah portion, which talks so much about passing and death, is called Vayechi, which means that he lived. Yeah. So you have here this notion of life coming full circle, even in death. A tzaddik is called alive. You have many different themes that we can. Speak of. In fact, the Talmud says.
Oh, you said a tzaddik is called.
Tzaddik is called alive. It's called alive.
Alive.
Yeah, even in his death, he's called alive. In fact, the Talmud says that Yaakov Avinu lo meis, Jacob, our forefather, never died. And the Talmud says, "What do you mean?" It says at the end that they embalmed him, they eulogized him, and said, "Mazaro b'chaim, afu b'chaim." Just as his children live, he too lives. So if we're around, if Bnei Yisrael, if the children of Israel are around, then Yisrael / Yaakov is still on some level alive.
So, that's why it said that you can feel the presence of tzaddik more strongly after they pass.
It definitely says that, and there's a famous letter printed toward the end of the book of Tanya that speaks to that. It's based somewhat on this and somewhat on other mystical sources as well. I want to focus on the opening verse. If you look back at the opening verse, the Torah gives us a little bit of a timing, gives us account of years. It says that Yaakov lived 17 years in the land of Egypt, and then it says the total amount of Yaakov's years are 147 years. Tell me what you find strange about this.
After Noah, wasn't the lifespan limited to 120?
Well, Abraham lived 180, Isaac 175, Isaac lived 180. There were some exceptions, but that's a good question. I don't have a good answer for it. It's a good question. What else? Any questions on the opening verse?
Didn't know how long he lived in Egypt.
Okay, good. Why do we need to know how long he lived in Egypt? Yeah.
There's a lot of repetition. So that you've got the total of Yaakov's days, and then the years of
right.
life, and then were 147 years. So why?
Well, it's written days and years and his life.
Kind of a
good. What else?
wondering what happened before he was 130 all that time. He was captured.
Yeah.
There's no accounting of that.
Well, we do know that he grew up with his twin brother, and he went to Lavan eventually, and he spent time, and he was, yeah, I mean, there.
They only talk about the time he lived in Egypt.
Here.
Focusing on that, here.
Here, yeah. Yeah. Good, well, I mean, that's in the narrative, it makes sense, that's where he is right now. Look, I'll mention a few other questions. Number one, last week's Torah portion, like I mentioned before, Yaakov told Pharaoh that he's 130 when he comes down. So if you tell me that he lived 17 years in Egypt, I know the total is 147. I'll ask you another question, yeah.
Okay.
The other question that I have is, and this is unusual, by every, whenever you find the lifespan of a person mentioned in Torah, it's always in association with his passing. It says that so-and-so breathed his last, he passed away, and he lived whatever it was. This is told at the beginning of the Torah portion. Before he passes away. It's like summarizing his lifespan, but he's still going on. He's still blessing, requesting, prophesying about his sons and the tribes and everything. And then it says, and he passes away, and he's buried, and whatever, and then it doesn't mention how old he was, because it already did at the beginning. But why at the beginning? For example, turn back to the end of the Torah portion. Look back at the end of the Torah portion where Yosef. Sorry. No worries. It's all good. It's only paper, exactly. I think we flipped too many pages. All right, 3:4. Look at 3:41. Look at the last verse of the book of Bereishis. Yosef died at the age of 110. They embalmed him and he was placed in a coffin in Egypt. In other words, his lifespan is count, or his years are counted when he passes away. When it comes to Yaakov, it's counted at the top. So I want to share with you. Yeah.
I was going to say also, the subject of that sentence is not Yaakov. The subject is years.
Right. The years of his life were good. There's a focus on years and life. Okay. So I want to share with you a commentary. The commentary of the Baal HaTurim. Now, the Baal HaTurim lived about 700 or 800 years ago. About 700 years ago. The Baal HaTurim is, yeah, I think paper is fine. The Baal HaTurim, it was one of the great halachic codifiers of Jewish law in Jewish history, one of the greats of all time. And he also, the Baal HaTurim was also a someone well-versed in numerology and in the remez dimension of Torah interpretation. So what is the verse hinting to? What are the allegorical messages that are not the literal messages? The allegory of Torah. So I want to share with you a famous teaching of the Baal HaTurim on our opening verse. And you can find it in the Torah Studies text. Please open up the Torah Studies text or the Torah Studies book to page number 224. All right, page 224. Sarah, if you, we'll skip straight to you. If you have it. All right, 224. Take it away. Text 2A.
Jacob lived 17 years in the land of Egypt. Since his early...
So I'm going to start there.
Jacob lived 17 years in the land of Egypt. Since his earlier years were not truly alive, due to his mourning for Joseph, about which he said, I will go down mourning my son in the afterlife.
Baal HaTurim says that when did Yaakov live? When did Jacob truly live? He truly lived in the land of Egypt. His early years, he wasn't considered alive because he went through so much difficulty. His son was, he was separated from his beloved son Joseph. And so the last 17 years that he lived in Egypt, those are the ones that he truly vayechi. He truly lived. And that's what the Torah emphasizes right at the beginning of the Torah portion. He lived there for 17 years, and that was what made his life a life. You can't understand this fully 2a without text 2b. Please continue. The Alshech, Rabbi Moshe Alshech, who lived a few centuries later, he elaborated on this interpretation, and it's so powerful. Please take it away.
Jacob lived. That is to say, The only years called life were the 17 years he spent in Egypt. It is because of the first half of the verse that Jacob lived in Egypt that the second half of the verse, Jacob's life came to 147 years, is true.
In other words, without the 17 years in Egypt, he doesn't live. He doesn't really live 147 years. Why? He explains.
This is human nature. One may live for 1,000 years in peace and repose, followed by a few bitter and agonizing years leading to death, and it will seem as if all one's life was filled with days of pain and darkness.
How powerful is that? Mm. Right? It all goes by the end, right? If the end is difficult, it seems like the whole life might have been, God forbid, miserable. Continue. The reverse?
The reverse is also true. Most of one's days were lived in pain, and they improved only near the end, and one died in satisfaction. The good days will seem to have paid for all of one's toil, as if all of one's life was equally good. This is what the verse comes to tell us, that if not for the 17 years in Egypt, all of Jacob's days would have been called sojourning in this world, but not living. And whatever good he had would have been lost among the majority of sorrow. But because his years in Egypt were alive, they transformed all his days, so that he lived for 147 years. This is why the days of his life are referred to in the singular, because they were, in his life, all equally good, redeemed by the last 17.
So the Torah, between the Baal Turim and the Auschach, we have all the questions answered, and it's all amazing. First of all, before we take a deep dive in analyzing these two interpretations, let me share one other tidbit of information. The numerical value of the word tov, which is good, is tes is 9, vav is 6, and bet is 2. What is that?
17.
So 17 is the numerologically equivalent to tov, which is good. Which is why, when I played Little League baseball, my number, of course, was 17. Because 18 was taken, so I had to opt for the next best, which was 17. Which is good. It's a good number. All right, so tov is 17. So the Baal Turim says that which years were the good years, right? The good years, not the tires, the good years of Jacob's life, the ones in Egypt. And the Auschach explains that this necessarily affects the 147 years and made them a life worth living. Because had it ended, God forbid, on a sour note, right? It would have ruined everything. That's the human nature, he says. But if it ends on a positive note, it reclaims all the difficulty and he lives. In retrospect, the whole thing is considered to be a good life, a life worth living. And so that's why when the Torah talks about, first of all, the Torah emphasizes that the years in Egypt were 17, because 17 is good. And they were the best years of his life, number one. And as soon as it mentions that, it has to mention the rest of his years. And it doesn't wait until he passes away. Why? Because it's telling us that those years reclaimed or uplifted the totality of his life, of all of his years, the 147 years in total. Make sense? Good. So we have answers to all the questions. And all of this leads us into a conversation that occurred between the Tzemach Tzedek and the Alter Rebbe. The Alter Rebbe, of course, was the founder of Chabad. His name was Rabbi Schneur Zalman of Liadi. His grandson became, when he grew up, his grandson became the third Rebbe, known as the Tzemach Tzedek. His name was Rabbi Menachem Mendel, and he lived in the city of Lubavitch. And when he was a boy, the Tzemach Tzedek, before he became the Tzemach Tzedek, when he was a young boy, he asked his grandfather a question on our verse and on the interpretation of the Baal Turim. Take a look at text number 3. Mike, please read text number 3, 226.
When the Tzemach Tzedek was a boy and learned the passage, Jacob lived in the land of Egypt 17 years, his teacher translated according to the Baal HaTurim commentary, our father Jacob lived his 17 best years in Egypt. When he returned home from school, he asked his grandfather, Alter Rebbe, how can it be that our father Jacob, the elect of the patriarchs?
I guess the Bedich, yeah, the Bechir, it's...
Yeah. Should have as the best years of his life the 17 that he lived in Egypt, the land of corruption. The Alter Rebbe answered, it is written, and Judah he sent before him to Joseph to give instructions for Goshen. The Midrash states, and Rashi quotes, that Rabbi Nechamil said to establish a house of study so that Torah would be there and the tribes would study the Torah. To give instructions for Goshen means, in a deeper sense, that when one learns the Torah, he comes closer to the Almighty. May he be blessed. So even in Egypt, it was true to say, Vayechi, he lived.
So we have a question from a grandson, and an answer from the grandfather, and it's recorded. It's recorded by our rebbes, by the Chabad rebbes, and printed in Hayom Yom in the rebbe's thought for the calendar of thought for each day, for the 18th day of Tevet. Again, let's go through the question and the answer, and then we have a lot to talk about on this. The question that the young boy asks his grandfather, asks his Zaidi, is the following: he learns in Cheder. He learned in school that the Baal HaTurim says that the 17 years that Jacob lived in Egypt were the best of his life. So he says, how's that possible? How's it possible that Yaakov, the highest of all the patriarchs, which we'll discuss in a moment why he was the highest, but on one level he's considered to be the greatest of the patriarchs, how could it be that the 17 best years of his life would be in Egypt? And his grandfather answers, it's because of what Yaakov did before he came down to Egypt. What did he do? He sent Yehuda. And what did he send Yehuda to do? To open up a yeshiva from where Torah would be taught and studied. And because that happened, that's why it was the best years of his life, because there was a yeshiva in Egypt. That's what his grandfather answers him, in short. Yes? Yes? We just read that. Right?
Yes.
I feel like a magician. Nothing on my sleeves, right? Nothing in my pockets. Okay. Oh, I always do. You know it. Let's put this aside for a moment. Let's put this exchange aside for a moment. I want to ask you the question cold. Obviously, it's not cold because we have this in our minds, but imagine I asked you cold. Tell me, can you think of ideas? How would you explain this explanation about Torah? How do you understand it? Why the 17 years that Yaakov lived in Egypt, why were these the best years of his life? Give me a humanistic answer.
He's back with Yosef.
Back with Yosef! Right?
And his whole family.
And his whole family. Perfect. You guys are walking right into it. I mean, you guys are right there with me. Right? In very humanistic terms, right? Why are these the best years of his life? He's got Yosef back. 17 years with Yosef. He had 17 years. By the way, Yosef was sold as a slave when he was 17 years old. And then he was gone for 22 years or so. And now he has another 17 years. So on a very simple human level, why are these the best years? Because he's back with Yosef. Now, the good student might ask, but wait a second, what about the first 17 years? Okay, what you have after loss is more appreciated than what you had before you lost it, right? So when Yaakov, of course he enjoyed the first 17 years that he had with Yosef, his beloved son, the firstborn of his beloved wife, Rachel. But you can imagine that the joy, the nachas, the pleasure, the pride, the spiritual ecstasy that he had with Yosef, after all the heartbreak and after all the distance, in their reunion for the last 17 years, that trumped everything. You can imagine that was the best years of his life on a very human level. Adding to it another layer, he's reunited with his whole family. You have to understand, he had so much drama since he was a child, right? He grew up with a brother like Esav, right? He grew up with a brother like Esav. He had to run away from home, basically. His parents told him to go, but basically had to run away from his brother who wanted to kill him. He was with a father-in-law like Lavan, again, right, with family like this, right? He goes back, he reunites with Esav, and everything seems good, and then Dina is abducted, his daughter is abducted, and then you have the drama of Yosef. So it's like one after the other, and finally now, the last 17 years of his life, he lives in peace and tranquility, and everyone's living together, and no one's fighting, at least it's not recounted anywhere. They're just fighting, right? The whole 17 years is summarized in this verse, by the way. This opening verse, Vayechi, is all we have about those 17 years. Last week's Torah portion talks about when Yaakov comes down to Egypt. This Torah portion talks about Yaakov basically in the last days or months or whatever of his life. What about those 17 years? They're summarized in one verse. Yaakov lived in Egypt for 17 years. What happened? No drama. That's great for Yaakov. So on a very human level, if you were the Alter Rebbe, if you were the grandfather, and the grandson asks you, why were these 17 years the best years of his life? You could easily answer, because he was reunited with Yosef. Because he was reunited with his whole family. Because nothing went wrong. No one was abducted. No one wanted to kill anybody. No one sold anyone as a slave. No drama. It's a good answer. Not the answer the Alter Rebbe gives. Talks about Yaakov sending Yehuda to Goshen ahead to open a yeshiva, Torah. So we need to understand why the Alter Rebbe doesn't give his grandson a very simple answer. Let's take a look, before we get to that, let's take a look at text. Let's see, should we do any of these texts over here? Kind of summarize 4a, 4b, 4c. No, I don't think we need to read it. Okay, let's move on. So here we go. The reason we could say, and all of this that we're discussing tonight, all of this comes from a talk that the Rebbe gave in analyzing this seemingly innocent story between a grandson and a grandfather. And we're going to derive an incredible lesson about education, because at the core of what I'm asking is, how does a grandfather answer his grandson? What does he choose to answer? He doesn't give the simple humanistic answer. He doesn't say, right, this is education. Straight, I told you at the beginning, earn it or win it, I don't know. I don't know what this is on. I do know, but that's off. This is like off topic. The core of tonight, the point tonight is, how do you educate a child? How do you educate the inner child? We all have the inner child. What is the key to education? So again, the question is, why were these the best years of his life? The answer is not just because he was reunited with his family and he had Yosef back, and Yosef was righteous. Oh, I meant to add. And Yosef was still righteous. He hadn't, like, you know, in 22 years in Egypt, he hadn't, you know, strayed or whatever it is from the teachings that he taught him. Yosef was who he was when he knew him, and even better than ever. That's not what he told him. Why? Because his grandson, see, there's an art in answering a question. There's also an art in asking a question. How to ask a good question. You see, his grandson, the Tzemach Tzedek, didn't just ask, how are these the best 17 years of his life? If that's what he asked, if that's what he would have asked, then maybe he could have given him the answers that we just floated. But he didn't ask just that. If you look back at the question in text number 3, he said, how can it be that our father Jacob, the elect of the patriarchs, meaning the great, the select, the chosen one of the patriarchs, should have as the best years of his life, the 17 that he had in Egypt, the land of corruption. You see, he adds a few details. Number one, who Yaakov is, and number two, where he was. The question is not simply why these years are better than Manishtana, Hashanim Hazot. What differentiates these years from the other years? That would be a simple answer. He had Yosef, he was reunited. That wasn't the question. The question is, how can we fathom that the best years of his life, God should orchestrate, they should be in Egypt, a land of corruption? Why is it a question? It's a question because two things. First of all, understanding the greatness of Yaakov, and second of all, understanding the depravity of Egypt. So let's jump to text number 5. Steve, please read text number 5, page 230.
Mitzrayim, Egypt, stems from the word mitzar, constraint, connoting the concealment of God.
The Alter Rebbe, the grandfather of our story, he writes, he teaches in Torah Ara, which is known as the Chassidish Parsha, the Chassidic teachings on the Torah portion, he writes that Mitzrayim, the word, the Hebrew word for Egypt, Mitzrayim, is related to the word Meitzar. Not only related, that's what it means. It means Meitzar, which means constraint. Meitzar is like a narrow space. What does it mean in this context? It connotes the concealment of God. It means that God is restricted, divine revelation is restricted, it's concealed, it's hidden. In other words, if there's concealment of God throughout the universe, and we know that you don't look outside and see God immediately, you have to meditate and ponder and uncover God. If that's true throughout the entire world, in Egypt, it's even worse. The concealment is even greater. Let's continue text number 6. We up the ante. Tim.
Rabbi Berechia said in the name of Rabbi Shimon and Lakish, for everything that God created in man, he created a parallel in the earth. Man has a head, and the earth has a head, as it is written, the head of the dust of the earth. Man has eyes, and the earth has eyes, as it is written, and he covered the eye of the earth. Man has ears, and the earth has ears, as it is written, give ear, O earth. Man has a stomach, and the earth has a stomach, as the verse says, living at the stomach of the earth. Man has a place of nakedness, and the earth has nakedness. As Joseph said about Egypt, you have come to scout out the nakedness of the earth. Man has legs, and the earth has legs, as the verse says, and the earth stands forever.
So this is a very nice midrash that talks about how the earth, in various verses, the earth is spoken of in parallel terms to the human body. But here's the point, when it comes to the nakedness, if you will, of the earth, which land is that? Erevas Haaretz, the nakedness of the earth, it's referring to Egypt. Which means in spiritual terms that if the whole earth, if the whole world is a place in which, you know, not always good things happen, certainly when it comes to Egypt, not certainly, when it comes to Egypt, Egypt is the lowest of the lands. Egypt was steeped in immorality, it was steeped in idolatry, it was steeped in all the negative things, all the negative vices that you can imagine. That's what ancient Egypt looked like. And so now we have a deeper insight into the question of the grandson that Tzemach said that to his grandfather. It wasn't just, why were these 17 years the best years of his life? It was, how could these 17 years be the best when Yaakov, who was this great tzaddik, was steeped in Erevas Haaretz, in the lowest, most degrading place on earth? How can we imagine that he would have the best years of his life living in such a depraved land, such a lowly land of concealment, of spiritual impropriety, etc.? How could it be? Text 7 talks about why Yaakov, where we see, again, the Midrash talks about how Yaakov was the chosen of the patriarchs, of all of the forefathers. We don't need to read it inside. The point is, the point I think is clear. Again, to summarize, before we move on to another depth in understanding the story. To summarize, we have a question and an answer. The question is, why are these the best years of his life, the 17 best years of his life? The grandfather answers, because of the Torah, the yeshiva that they opened, and the Torah that was studied, etc. Our question was such a complicated answer. Give a simple answer. And what we've explained thus far is that you can't just give a simple answer because it wasn't a simple question. He asked, how could Yaakov's best years be in the most depraved land, in the most spiritually unfit land? To answer that, you have to speak in spiritual terms. You cannot just give me, well, his family was together. Now, that's not a good enough answer. The question posits a spiritual deficiency. The answer has to address the spiritual deficiency. Make sense? Yes? Good.
Also, going back to this being a very spiritual question, goes to the Hasidic perspective that the greatest light is in the deepest challenges.
Oh, hold on one second. Hold on. That's our next section.
All right. Next section.
But he also didn't answer that.
Yeah, he didn't answer that.
Which is what we're about to get to.
Okay.
So now we understand that the grandson, the Tzemach Tzedek, is asking a deeply spiritual question, and it's bothering him. You have a tzaddik of the tzaddikim, a tzaddik tzaddik, if you will, right? The chosen of the patriarchs who were chosen. The chosen of the chosen. You know, they call Alaskan Jews the frozen chosen, the frozen chosen, or the chosen frozen, or something like that. But here we have the chosen. It could work for Alaska. It could work for so many different lands. Siberia. All right. Montreal, we'll throw Montreal in there, the Habs. Okay, so again, it's a spiritual question. How could the best, for Yaakov, such a spiritual person, how could the best years of his life be in such a spiritually desolate wasteland? I have a good answer. I have Karen's answer. You know why? Because the greatest light comes from the greatest darkness. So if you can maintain your spiritual integrity, if you can retain your Jewishness in the land of Egypt, it's not just on par with whatever you had in the land of Canaan, the land of Israel. It's so much greater because you still maintained your integrity amidst Erevas Haaretz, amidst the depravity of the earth. You still maintain your spiritual posture. You maintain your Jewish identity. Oh, that is so much more powerful. The light, think about it this way. What is the value of a flashlight? What's the coolest flashlight you know? I'll tell you, when I was growing up.
The one on my head, have you seen that?
Oh, that's epic.
You know what I'm talking about?
Yes, but I did not expect that answer. You're talking about the one that you wear, yeah. The coal miner action.
I have one.
How do you know that you...
People wear that right in their butt.
Because she carried.
Oh, you like carried around?
I carried with me when I got it.
Oh, this is fantastic. All right. When I was growing up, what was in the 80s, late 80s, maybe early 90s, I'm not sure, I don't remember anymore, it's been a while, the Maglite. Remember the Maglite? Those big flashlights, those big like police flashlights. I was so proud. I went away to camp, overnight camp, and I got like the big one, like the D-cell one with the whole, like, super heavy. Oh, my God, I could not schlep that thing. It was, like, heavier than I was. Whatever. Okay, so here's the point. What is the value of a flashlight in the middle of the day? Right?
You use it for a weapon.
Okay. Well, with a maglite. Yeah. No, but with the focusing on the light, right? What's the value of a flashlight when it's bright outside?
I love that.
Garnished. Yeah. But what about in a dark space? What's the value of a flashlight? It's very valuable. It's very needed. And you can see it. You can see it. It benefits. It's valuable. You love it. You appreciate it. It's wonderful. It gives you joy. And it makes your day. Well, okay, maybe I'm going overboard here. But it's beneficial.
Makes your day brighter.
Oh, or your night brighter. Right. But in the middle of the day, the flashlight doesn't do anything. So too, classic Jewish teaching is that the light that's in a space of darkness is that much more beautiful, that much more brilliant, that much more necessary and needed and appreciated and valued, etc. So, Yaakov was a tzaddik in Canaan, which would become the land of Israel. Even then it was on some sort of a higher level. And his sons on their own level, they had their own spiritual high level of sanctity. Spiritually, they had a very high level as well. Notwithstanding the Yosef story, however we understand that, they also had their elevated level. But how valuable was it in Israel? Go to Egypt and see if you still maintain your spiritual integrity. Go to Egypt and see if you still... You know, keep what you need to be keeping. That's more of a challenge. And if you do it, the light is so much brighter. It's noticed, it's brighter, it's more valuable, it's beautiful, and it gives more joy. So I have another answer that grandfather, that the Zayde, could have answered his grandson. When his grandson, and this is a spiritual answer, When his grandson asked him, how could it be that the best years of Yaakov, Bechir Sheba Avos, the greatest of the patriarchs, how could his best years, Sukhazon, be in Egypt, Ervas Ha'ar is the lowest of the lands? I have a good answer. This is a really good answer, I think. Spiritual answer. Because the best years are the ones in which you still maintain your spiritual integrity despite it being Ervas Ha'ar, despite it being such a depraved land. If you can stay, if you and your family retain their Jewish identity, retain their mission in life, despite the surroundings, oh, how could that not be the best? Of course that's the best. That's better than anything you could have achieved. Because the lower it is, the greater the accomplishment. The lower the environment, the greater the light that emanates. The darker the darkness, the brighter the light. The greatest light emanates from the darkest of places. So of course it's the greatest year. Of course it's the 17 best years of his life. Guess who doesn't answer that?
Well, that can lead to a big problem.
Which is?
Are you supposed to seek out?
Oh, okay. Good. So hold that thought for a second. So notice that the Alter Rebbe does not answer that. It might seem, maybe he's saying that. He talks about Torah and the yeshiva. Maybe that's what he means. It's not what he says. That's not what he says. He doesn't tell his grandson, you know why it's the best years of his life? Because even in Egypt, they remain Jewish. That's not what he says. He talks about Torah. So now the question is, why doesn't he give this powerful answer about light and darkness and the blinding light, the greatest light being unleashed from the darkest of places? Why doesn't he give that answer? Such a beautiful, romantic answer. Especially for a bright child. All puns always intended. Yes, Sunny. Good. So he doesn't answer this. Rather, he gives an answer about Torah. To understand why he doesn't answer the light answer, but rather gives him an answer about Torah study, we need to understand what the answer was. What exactly did the Alter Rebbe tell his grandson? What did he say? That why were they the best years of his life? Because he sent Yehuda ahead to open a yeshiva and they studied Torah. How does that answer the question? Because they studied Torah? So what? How was it the best years of his life? And he didn't say, they still studied Torah in Egypt. That's greater than studying Torah outside. That's not what he says. That's the light and darkness then. He says something about studying Torah in and of itself. To understand this, in other words, we have a few questions on the table now. The question is, why doesn't the grandfather give this powerful spiritual answer of light and darkness? Number one. And number two, what is the answer that he actually gave? Let's try to understand that, and then we'll explain which answer is better for a child. So what is Torah? And how does Torah answer the question, what answer did the Alter Rebbe really give to his grandson? Let's look at text number 8. Karen, 233.
The Torah is compared to water, for just as water descends from a higher to a lower level, so has the Torah descended from its place of glory, which is His blessed will and wisdom. For the Torah and the Holy One, blessed be He, are one and the same, and no thought can apprehend Him at all. The Torah has progressively descended through hidden stages, stage after stage, with the descent of the worlds, until it integrated into corporal substances and in things of this world, comprising almost all of the commandments of the Torah, their laws, and in the combinations of material letters written with ink in a book, namely the 24 volumes of the Torah, prophets and writings. God did this so that every thought should be able to apprehend the Torah. Thus, inasmuch as the Torah and its commandments clothe all 10 faculties of the soul with all its 613 organs from head to foot, the soul is altogether truly bound up in the bundle of life with God, and the very light of God envelops and integrates within it from head to foot.
Okay, so he begins by talking about Torah, and Torah is compared to water. We had a class about Torah being compared to various liquids recently, so here we have a deeper understanding of what it means that Torah is compared to water. Water descends from a high place to a low place. Water always seeks the lowest point. Torah also goes down from above to below, and he says, as Torah comes below and a person understands Torah, a person is understanding the very wisdom of God, the very will of God, the will and wisdom of the Holy One, blessed be He. So that's one point. Let's take a look at text number 9. Let's further this with another text, page 234. David.
By the illumination of your face, you gave us the Torah of life. Even as the Torah is given to us in this worldly form, it is still the illumination of your face. That is, it reaches up to the depths of the infinite Creator Himself, the worldly Torah, the same Torah as the one above.
In other words, just like water, just to combine these two texts now, just like when water flows down a mountain, it's the same drop that started at the top that's now tumbling down the mountain. It's the same Torah, that's divine wisdom, pure divine wisdom, that tumbles down throughout the unit, throughout the successive stages of spiritual evolution into our finite reality, compressed into the 22 letters of the alphabet, written on ink on parchment in a Torah scroll, dealing with physical items and physical issues and physical laws. It's the very will and wisdom of God as it existed above in physical form. But it's the pure divine will and wisdom. It's the same purity below as it was above. Continue.
In this regard, the Torah is unlike God's will to create the worlds, in which the lower the spiritual worlds continue to unfold, the more concealed godliness is. It is only in the highest of the spirit of the supernal worlds that the authentic infinite expression of God is felt, whereas in the lower worlds only His most superficial expression is experienced, and His authentic expression is hidden. It is the very definition of the lower worlds, that is, their finite nature, that conceal Him. In the Torah, however, the same authentic infinite light descends down even to our physical world without changing at all. The finitude of Torah, unlike the finite nature of the worlds, does not conceal Him in the least.
This is an incredibly powerful text, and this is something that in and of itself can transform your life and certainly your perspective of Torah, but I think in your life as well. Everything in existence comes from God. Right? The mountains come from God and the Torah comes from God. So what's the difference? God created everything. So what's the difference? Simple. When you look at a mountain, what do you see? A mountain. A clod of earth. A lot of earth piled up forming a mountain. And when you see the Torah, what do you see? God's will and wisdom, that's what you see. The Torah is pure even as it descends. Everything else, I'm trying to think of a good physical example. Everything starts off with God. But as it tumbles through Seder Hishtalshelut, as it tumbles through the spiritual evolution of the worlds, it becomes more concealed and more rough and more concealed and more opaque until it takes on and things assume physical form. And when you look at it, all you see is it, and you don't see the spirit, you don't see the divine power inside. Torah is different. Torah doesn't get affected by its descent down the worlds throughout the various spheres and worlds and chambers to this world. Torah remains pure. It's like in a time capsule. It's like a throwback from another planet. Torah is, it's pure. It's pure divinity. It's pure godliness. It's divine will and wisdom as it is in the source. So everything else is affected by its descent into this world. Torah is not affected. It's unaffected by the descent. It remains pure and 100% divine, inside and outside. So what happens when you study Torah? This is the kicker. Oh, let's summarize text 10. It's a little bit lengthy to read inside. Text 10 says, not only is Torah like stepping into a portal into another planet, another universe. It's like when you study Torah, it's like you're stepping into the space of God. Not only that, but Torah is unique among all the 613 commandments. Torah, it's also a mitzvah to study Torah. Torah is unique in, yeah, thank you. It's your cue. It's 8:25, time to close the door. Thank you. My thought is it's probably not going to help too much, but it'll help a little bit.
Huh? Yeah, a little bit.
All right, not bad. You have to soundproof this chamber. Again, that's right. Not only is Torah stepping into another reality, But Torah is unique in that when you study Torah, you grasp the Torah. Are you with me? Every other mitzvah, you're involved within it, with it on somewhat of a superficial level. It's like you wrap tefillin, you light candles, you give tzedakah. You might feel it, you might do it. Certainly you're doing it if you're doing it. But Torah is unique in that it's inside your mind. Your mind is grasping it. You get it. You understand it. You own it. It's called mazon. It's called food for the soul. The other mitzvot are called clothing, garments of the soul. Because even when you do the mitzvah, it doesn't become you. It doesn't become part of you. You did it, but it doesn't become part of you. Torah, though, it's like you digest it. It's mazon. It's food for the soul. Food for the body, spiritually. Right? Because it goes inside you. So it... Understand what's happening here. And by the way, he says, the Alter Rebbe explains in Tanya, chapter 4 and chapter 5, that when you study Torah, it's the closest you can get with God. No other experience matches it. What we're doing right now is the closest experience to getting that a human being can get with God. Why? First of all, number one, Torah is, it's a divine expression right here on earth. Number one, it's God's will and wisdom. Number two, when you study Torah, when you and I study Torah, it's going inside our minds. We're getting it. We understand it. And at that moment that we're studying, it gets us. You know why? Because you're not thinking about other things. Oh, now you're probably, now I just, right. Wait, what am I not thinking about? Now you're thinking about it. But you're captured by it, and it's captured by you. It's got your mind, and you have it in your mind. So it's, as he says in Tanya, he says it's a yichud nifla, a wondrous unification between two entities. That there's nothing like it in the universe that exists. Mikol tzad upina, from every side and angle, when you're involved in studying Torah, you are completely immersed in it. It's immersed in you. And what are you immersed in? Pure divinity. So now we understand. Oh, now we're getting closer to understanding. What did the grandfather tell the grandson? What did Zayda? What did the Alter Rebbe tell his grandson? His grandson asked him, "Tell me, how could these 17 years for Yaakov Avinu? How could the best years be in Egypt?" And she says, "You know what happened in Egypt? You know what happened? There was a yeshiva there. And you know what happens when you step into yeshiva and you study Torah? What happens to the Egypt around you? Disappears. When you study Torah, what happens to the whole world of distraction? The world of craziness, mishagas? Let's talk about the mishagas for a second. Let's talk about this. You look at any news site, anything in the world, news, entertainment, sports. Okay, maybe not sports. Sports is fine. But especially if it's Pittsburgh sports, and then it's absolutely... Baruch Hashem. It's right one notch. Okay. But otherwise, the world. It's Meshuggah. All the craziness. It's Olam Shel Sheker. It's a false world. What's up is down. What's down is... What's right is... What should be up is down. What should be down is up. It's a world of opposites. It's a world that doesn't make any sense. So what is the grandfather telling the grandson? Do you know how to maintain? Do you know how to have good years even in Egypt? What's he telling his grandson? Study Torah. Because when you study Torah, you step into a different reality. You leave Egypt behind. You leave Atlanta behind. You leave Olam Hazeh, this world behind. You leave everything behind. You leave politics. You leave entertainment. You leave CNN and Fox News. I'm going all right. In the New York Times and the New York Post and TMZ. You leave everything else behind. And you step into a place of pure divinity. And what happens? You're grasped by it. It's got you. And you have it. It has you. And you have it. And what is it that you have? And what is it that has you? Pure divinity. So the grandson asks his grandfather, not just about Yaakov. You see, a good answer is knowing what the question is. It's answering the questioner, not just the question. Grandson is asking, how can I live a good life amidst all of the craziness, all the mishagats, all the distractions, all the falsities of this world, all the vanities, King Solomon writes, Hevel havolam hakol hevel, vanity of vanities, it's all vanity, it's all false. Our pursuits of materialism, you can't take it with you. You know the famous story about the wealthy guy who passes away? And he writes, he tells his children, before he passes away in his deathbed, one thing please, you have to promise, to bury me in my socks. And the family is a dying man's wishes. They're the patriarch of the family, they say, of course. Passes away. They tell the Chevra Kaddish, the Jewish Burial Society, about their father's wishes. And they say, we can't honor these wishes. It's contrary to Jewish law. Jewish law says you can't, only the burial shrouds, that's it. No other garments, not even socks. But our father wanted it. We can't do it. It's against halacha. Where he is now, he certainly recants on his wishes and he certainly wants what Jewish law says. Fine. So they say fine. And they don't bury him in his socks. Later on, they found a letter. He hid a letter somewhere and they opened up the letter. They found that the family found the letter that the father had written before he passed away. And he says, by now, I'm sure you've already buried me. And by now, you know that you can't take anything with you, not even a pair of socks. Can't take anything with you. Hevel, havolim, hakol hevel, King Solomon says in Ecclesiastes. Vanity of vanities, in other words, what's vanities? Think of like a bathroom vanity. No. Hevel means emptiness. It's all empty. It's all empty. It's nice while we have it, but it's all empty in the long run. Reminds me of the sign scene in Visiting Day in Camp, in the staff lounge, when the parents were going through. Money is the root of all evil. Leave your evil here. Don't forget to tip your accounts. Anyway. But it's all emptiness. So a grandson is asking his grandfather. The Tzemach Tzedek is asking the Alter Rebbe. How can I live a good life, the best life, in a place like Egypt? Well, you think Russia a few hundred years ago was Jerusalem in the times of the Temple? It wasn't. And his grandfather tells him, study Torah. Study Torah. And that's it. Transport it to a different reality. All the craziness you leave behind. And you enter the pure space of Torah. What he didn't answer his grandson is about the power of withstanding the negativity and even in a negative space, transforming the darkness to light by doing a mitzvah and breaking the darkness and unleashing light. Because for a child is educated in a place of purity. We tell a child, we protect our children. You don't throw a child into a challenging situation and say, go transform it. That's when we get older. When we're still young, we have to be educated and we have to educate our children, grandchildren, children. We have to educate the youth. Right? The youth, we have to educate in a space of purity. Find your place of purity. Study Torah. You don't need all the distractions. We don't need to distract our children and say, fight against it. We don't need to give them extra challenges and say, right? It's like, do we need to give our kids devices and say, like, and then say, but only use it for? Wouldn't it be pure to just create a beautiful, pure space for them to grow up in without the mishagas? Again, every situation is different and whatever it is, but in concept, in ingret, in concept, this is the point. The Alter Rebbe is teaching his grandson, is not telling him about the virtue and the value of grappling with darkness and unleashing its potential. That comes later. As a child, he's teaching his grandchild the lesson of purity. And it's a model for us in education and even for us on a daily basis. While there's power in transformation, in grappling with all the craziness, there's also intense power in purity. There's a lot of power in creating safe spaces for ourselves that are not mixed in to all the craziness of the world to then try to transform it. a space where it's just us and our purpose and the Torah or a mitzvah or a synagogue or whatever it is, a place of purity. Here's what you need to know. When the Tzemach Tzedek grew older and he became Rebbe, he actually asked this question himself in one of his discourses. And he gave an interesting answer. Take a look. Take a look at text 19a on page 243. Text 19a, page 243. Alex, I think we're up to you.
Regarding the same verse topic, Semitic, as a youth, once queried his grandfather on, he explained an adult in adulthood, and Yaakov lived in Egypt for 17 years. 17 years is the numerical value of the Hebrew word tov, good. Through 17 years in Egypt, Yaakov merited to reach a state of light and realize good, because light is greater when it comes from darkness. That is, through the descent into Egypt, Yaakov merited to greater light, which came from darkness.
So when the Tzemach Tzedek became older, and he himself asked this question, he gave his own answer about the value of light emanating from a space of darkness. The value of transforming darkness into light. Because that's when he was older and he had faced challenges. And he had the ability to withstand the challenges and transform it to light. But the Alter Rebbe, who was a good educator. How do you get a better educator than the Alter Rebbe, right? Talk about credentials. A tzaddik, a mystic, a Rebbe, the founder of Chabad. The Alter Rebbe knew his grandson. And he didn't give his grandson this answer. He gave him a different answer. He gave him an answer about Torah. About find your space of purity. Yaakov found his space of purity. And in that space of purity, he was able to forget the craziness of Egypt. And the message is, so can you and so can each one of us. When the Tzemach Tzedek grew older and became a Rebbe, he taught a different answer. And the answer is about the light that can be unleashed from the darkness itself. As the Rebbe explains in Likutei Sichot, Volume 10, which is where this whole class is based on, as our Rebbe explains, pedagogically, you have to teach in a space of purity. Don't create distractions and then try to encourage your children or students to overcome the distractions. Teach in a, because then it's even greater, because you're able to study even with the distractions. Don't play any games. Teach in a way of purity. Get rid of the distractions. Create a space of learning. Create a proper atmosphere. Give them the material that they need. Don't make it complicated. Don't teach in riddles. Because when they learn it, then they really learn. No games when they're young. The goal is to build up the strength from that pure place, to build up the strength to be able to understand and appreciate the value of grappling with darkness and transforming it to light. But again, that comes later. And I think for each one of us, we have these two modalities. We have the inner child and the seasoned veteran adult, right? The inner child needs purity. The inner child needs sanctity. The inner child needs a safe haven, a safe place to just be pure. The seasoned veteran inside of us needs a challenge, needs some darkness to grapple with, needs to create something from nothing, needs to be able to transform things from dark to light. Okay, so that comes later. Within our own lives, that's step two. But step one always has to be finding places of purity. And so, this is the way we model our day. We begin our day in prayer, in study, prayer, meditation. We begin our day in synagogue. We begin our day in a contemplative state, in a state of purity. And then we go out, step one, and then we go out into the world. And when we go out into the world, then we have the opportunity to transform light into darkness. If we miss out on step one, the likelihood of transformation diminishes greatly. In other words, if we don't have that place of absolute purity and safety from all the mishugas, from all the craziness, then the odds of us going into all of that, maintaining our head and being able to transform it into light, that possibility goes down severely. So we need the safety, we need the purity, we need that place of pure connection. And then we need the challenges afterwards. That constitutes a good day and a good education. Thank you very much for joining me tonight for Torah Studies.